It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this month, film buffs are celebrating Noirvember, looking at the film noir movies that helped reshape American moviegoing.
First, in a 15-minute speech last night, President Obama asserted his executive powers to grant temporary relief to some of the nearly 12 million immigrants who are currently living in the United States illegally.
Insisting that there was precedent for his order and similar actions by previous presidents, Obama said he's acting to mend a broken immigration system after years of gridlock and frustration on Capitol Hill.
In his plan, the president is calling for three broad actions: cracking down on illegal immigration at the border, deporting felons rather than families, and increasing accountability through background checks and taxes.
To provide a more detailed overview of the plan, we have with us Terry Givens, professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. She writes a blog on immigration at immigrationtexas.org. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, can you spell out who is among undocumented immigrants, who is and who isn't affected by what the president is doing?
So that's very important because it's parents of U.S. citizens and green card holders who will now be protected from deportation, as well as 290,000 more children who will be eligible for DACA, which is a deferred action for children or childhood arrivals.
And there's more than half of the people that we know of in the United States legally who would not be affected at all by this new action. Is that right?
That's right. So people who don't have children or who are who came here after a certain time will not be able to take advantage of this action.
Well, let's get into some of the specifics. There weren't all the details in this 15-minute speech, but one element, as we mentioned, of this executive action was border security and trying to crack down on illegal crossings at the border. What would that change?
So basically, that's going to shift some of the resources of ICE from internal enforcement to border enforcement. And so there's already been a federal surge to the border, and of course here in Texas we've taken our own state-level actions, but this will be focused on federal action, moving Border Patrol agents and ICE enforcement agents to the border.
And part of this also would involve, I gather, streamlining the immigration court process. And there's been a lot of talk of that, especially with the younger migrants coming up from Central America. How big a problem is the court system in determining whether migrants can stay?
Well, this has been a big problem because there's been major backups in the immigration courts. There haven't been enough judges or court advocates and so on, and so this has led to high levels of detentions for people coming across the border, including children who have been crossing the border alone.
And another element, the president said the nation should focus on deporting felons, not families, and the president wants to replace the Secure Communities Program with a new one called the Priority Enforcement Program. Those are the slogans for the programs. What would actually change, though?
Well, probably one of the biggest changes would be a shift in focus from minor infractions or misdemeanors to felons. And so in looking at what's been laid out so far, it looks like they're actually going to focus on people who, instead of placing detainers on people once they're brought into custody, they would wait and get a notification when people are leaving custody. And so the focus will also shift away from people who have, although there's been some concern about language talking about priority misdemeanors, and so we'll have to see how that plays out. But certainly the shift has definitely been more towards felons and avoiding separating families.
And there's been a controversy over what the federal government wants from local police departments when they encounter undocumented immigrants in any situation, whether they're arrested or not. Does this change anything moving forward at that level?
It might. So it's still a little unclear how this is going to play out. And I know our local Travis County executive has said she's waiting to see what the Homeland Security is going to say about this. But this has been a huge issue for local law enforcement. You have some police departments that are happy to check for identification papers and whether people are here legally. You've had others that have resisted. And so there's been a lot of controversy over Secure Communities. And even within Travis County, the sheriff's office has been more willing to use these procedures versus the local Austin City Police.
Now, one of the goals, according to the president, of using discretion in who gets prosecuted for immigration violations, one of his goals, he says, is keeping families together. What particular measures would support that focus?
Well, first of all, it means that they're going to give a legal, not legal status, but give a waiver to deportation to these specific people who have children who are either U.S. citizens or green card holders. So that's potentially 4.4 million people who can take advantage of that. So that's a very concrete measure that will allow those people to get out of deportation proceedings or at least come out of the shadows and register themselves so that they aren't concerned about being deported. So that's the key provision there.
Now, we've already had something, you mentioned it a bit earlier, called DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. What has that been? How does it change under this executive action?
So that's actually quite an interesting change. So first of all, DACA was only valid for 2 years, and they've extended that to 3 years. But even more important, they've removed the age limit, and they've also made people eligible who arrived before their 16th birthday before January 1st, 2010, before it was June 15th, 2007. So that opens up the door for example, people like Jose Antonio Vargas, who is a very well-known advocate for undocumented migrants, who himself was a journalist or is a journalist and has been advocating for this kind of change.
Now, we've got a big, fairly complicated immigration system. I think that's a bit of an understatement, actually, in the United States. In the big picture, how big a deal is President Obama's executive action considered in the broader scope of our immigration policy?
Well, I teach a class on immigration politics every year, and one of the things I tell my students is this is obviously a very complicated issue. And I think looking at the history of immigration politics in the U.S., this will be seen as a very big move, because it's one of the biggest moves by a president in terms of the numbers of people affected in terms of trying to do something to change their status. Now, it's not going to permanently change their status. It's temporary. And so for those of us who study immigration politics, this is going to be very, very fascinating to see what happens going forward.
Now, this is not a comprehensive immigration reform that I think reform advocates are looking for. It's not the fix that that Republicans are looking for either. Do you see any kind of big immigration change coming through Congress, getting signed by the president in, say, the next 2 years?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, I do believe we should have comprehensive immigration reform. I think it's important, and I think the reason President Obama moved forward with this is partly because he does think it's going to be very difficult to get something through, and his hope is that this will potentially push Congress to take action, or specifically the House of Representatives. But I think it's very unlikely. You know, we've got presidential politics kicking in, so it's going to be an interesting couple of years.
Could the backlash to this go-it-alone approach actually make it harder to pass any kind of comprehensive immigration reform down the road?
Yeah, that's certainly a big possibility, because you're going to have a lot of hardcore anti-immigration folks saying, no, we really, we can't move forward on this. And actually, if we do see legislation, I expect it to be focused on border security. So that's usually the focus initially, and that was clearly the first step thing that the president talked about in his speech. So definitely, I think we will see some border security measures at least put forward, if not necessarily passed.
Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Terry Givens. She's a professor in the Government Department at the University of Texas at Austin. She blogs at immigrationtexas.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
We take a break from the month of November and visit the shadowy, black-and-white, intrigue-filled world of Noirvember.
Some film fans have started a movement to watch film noir movies through the month of November and celebrate the Private Eyes, Double Crosses, Femme Fatale, and other film noir staples.
Our next guest teaches a course on film noir. It's on the schedule next semester. Jeff Smith is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison, and he joins us here in the studio. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I chatted with you earlier this week, and I understand this question is more complicated than I thought at first, but what is film noir?
Well, this is one of those issues where it's tough to find a really satisfying definition of what it is. It's easy to find where the term comes from, because it's kind of a French invention. It was term sort of formalized in the mid-1950s by a couple of French critics, Raymond Bord and Étienne Chaumetton, who wrote a book that was essentially a kind of encyclopedia of what they saw as American film noir. But even prior to that, in 1946, there were critics who were writing about dark film. And for the French, this was because of kind of wartime embargo of films during World War II. Once the market for American films had opened again, it was their first chance to see films like Maltese Falcon, Double Indemnity, Laura, Murder, My Sweet. And they saw connections between those films that had escaped a lot of American critics precisely because they were just kind of seeing them all at once.
What are some of the common elements of film noir?
Well, the most common traits that I think are associated with it are it's early on, the French noticed that these were kind of crime adventure stories. So they typically are, although not always, I would say, they involve some commission of a crime, and usually a sort of morally dubious or at least compromised hero. Often there will be as the dangerous female, the femme fatale. But then there are even more specific kinds of traits that tend to be associated with noir, such as the use of a flashback structure to tell the story, or voiceover narration, which often restricts what we know about the story to what the main character is telling us. But part of what makes noir tricky is when you start to look at a lot of the films that are often seen as kind of canonical noir stories, a lot of them lack one or other of these features, which is why sometimes it's harder to think of them as a genre per se. Some people want to think of them really as a style, emphasizing the iconography, the cinematography, which tends to be very dark and moody, pools of light, lots of shadow. In other cases, they want to think of it more as perhaps a mode, more like comedy, for example, which might cut across a number of different genres.
Well, let's check out one of the early defining movies that you mentioned, one of my favorite movies of all time, The Maltese Falcon. Here's Humphrey Bogart as Private Eye Sam Spade confronting Mary Astor as Bridget O'Shaughnessy, deciding whether he's going to turn her into the cops for killing his partner.
I've no earthly reason to think I can trust you, and if I do this and get away with it, you'll have something on me that you can use whenever you want to. Since I've got something on you, I couldn't be sure that you wouldn't put a hole in me someday. All those are on one side. Maybe some of them are unimportant. I won't argue about that. But look at the number of them. What have we got on the other side? All we've got is that maybe you love me and maybe I love you.
A private eye, a dead partner, a doomed relationship. That kind of cries out film noir, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it's often cited as one of the first. It's always, you know, in film studies, people will sometimes like to push those back a little further. Some people see Citizen Kane as a film noir, which kind of lacks that relationship to one of the key influences, which is hard-boiled literature. That's where Maltese Falcon seems like, to me at least, a much stronger candidate, precisely because many of these 40s noirs were adaptations of works by writers like Raymond Chandler and Cornell Woolrich and James M. Cain.
The music also catches your ear, doesn't it? You only need to hear a couple bars and you sort of know where you are.
I'm in noir land, yeah.
Yes, yeah, that's true. And it's one of the things that's often characteristic of these films is because there's an emphasis on kind of criminal psychology. Composers like to have fun by emphasizing more dissonance, tend to be more minor key. You know, a lot of the things that we talk about in terms of mood is set by the cinematography, but the music often also supports that as well.
Does it have to be black and white, or is that just that's what they used in the heyday of these movies.
I think it's more the case that that's what they used in the heyday of these movies, that you can even find some exceptions of Leave Her to Heaven, for example, a John Stahl film with Gene Tierney. She's Our Dangerous Female, but it's shot in beautiful Technicolor. So even in the 40s, you have some rare instances where you have kind of color noir.
Now, we've got another clip here to play from another classic. This one is Out of the Past. This is Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer.
Jeff, I had to come back. What else could I do?
You can never help anything, can you? You're like a leaf that the wind blows from one gutter to another. You can't help anything you do, even murder.
You can't say it was that.
I can say one thing. I buried him.
Clip from Out of the Past there, and you've sort of said this was a pinnacle of the age of noir. What is it about this one?
Well, I think it's the one film that, if you look at a lot of the things that everybody has said about film noir, it kind of brings it all together in a way that few other films do. There are a lot of critics, for example, who will mention that one strategy that film noir takes is to establish a kind of contrast between your dangerous female with someone who seems to be a much more virtuous, nicer alternative. And in fact, that's a pretty common strategy, but there's a way in which it plays out in Out of the Past in a much more stark and elaborate fashion than is typically true of a lot of other film noirs. So there's a way in which it just kind of gets everything that people tend to associate with noir all in one really nice framework.
Now, looking at lists of noir films, most of them cluster in the 1940s and 1950s. Was that really the golden age of film noir, looking back?
Yeah, I would say the golden age is certainly the 40s and 50s. Some people will suggest that, at least in terms of the earlier phase of noir, in other words, prior to what we now think of as neo-noir, that really ended probably in 1958. And some people will even say Orson Welles, Touch of Evil, that was kind of like the last real film noir that was made.
So here we are in Noirvember, an entire month for film noir aficionados. What is it that people like so much about the way these movies feel and what they do?
Well, one of the things that I think has always interested people long term is that Hollywood films, especially in the studio era, were typically full of, you know, the usual bromides, happy endings, could be quite sentimental, could be quite straight-laced in their own way. And noir really explores the kind of, you know, dark side of humanity. People have always had an interest in you know, the kinds of things that compel people to do what we know to be, you know, often really wrong-headed, make really wrong-headed decisions. And so it's that kind of fascination with the train wreck aspect of the way these stories go. And I mean, that's even a kind of metaphor that you get early on, the sense of fate and destiny in Double Indemnity. They talk about getting on, you know, the trolley goes down the tracks and it's only going one way and you can't get off. It's that element of noir that I think people respond to, as well as a sense of the kind of cynicism and toughness of the films. I think that's also very appealing.
You know, I don't know if I have my timeline right. I know once upon a time there was a moral code that I think the government applied to American movies. Did that overlap with noir, and how did that work, if it did?
Well, the Production Code Administration, there were different iterations of it throughout the 30s, but by 35, essentially the Production Code as we kind of know it remains in force really through the mid-1960s. But there was a general sense that the operation of the code was always something that was really negotiable. There are stories that I probably can't repeat on the air about, you know, problems that filmmakers would bring to the office, and they would work out solutions together. So one of the things that was suggested about noir is it was still made possible in part because one of the things the Production Code always emphasized was that there would be kind of narratives would provide some sense of moral compensation in the closure of the films, in the end of the films, so that as long as it ended with wrongdoers being punished, then the kind of scales get balanced. And I suppose that's one of the things that gave noir its emphasis on this fatalistic atmosphere. Typically, these films do not end well for anybody involved in them.
So you can have moral ambiguity and people considering these dark things and acting on them, but as long as everything squares up at the end, they're okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting.
We're talking to UW-Madison film professor Jeff Smith about film noir, what it is, how it's influenced movies, and what some of the great films in the genre or maybe style are, as we mark what some film buffs are celebrating as Noir-vember.
And you can join in. Do you have a favorite movie in the genre? Are you someone who would get into celebrating Noir-vember? Maybe you already are. Do you have a favorite in the genre of film noir? And how do you define it? What do you think are the real hallmarks of film noir? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Henry Mancini's music from A Touch of Evil will take us into the news here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. That's the theme from Double Indemnity. We continue our conversation about film noir from The Maltese Falcon to the present as we mark Noir-vember. UW-Madison film professor Jeff Smith is with us, and you can join the conversation.
Are you a fan of film noir, or are you noir curious? Call in with your favorite movies in the genre, the arguments maybe you have about it, and your questions, too. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll get to the phones right now. Jackie is our first caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. The movies I like in the noir genre are mostly Bogey movies, particularly The Big Sleep, Key Largo. And I'm not sure this other one would be really film noir, but I love They Rule the Night, which is dark and also ambiguous morality. But it's not really in the detective genre at all. But I really love that one.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Jackie. And bringing up Humphrey Bogart, he seems to be a common thread in a lot of these. And I'd love to know what it is you think about him as an actor that represents it. But also that the before we forget, what was the movie he did?
They Rule the Night.
They Rule the Night, yeah.
That one has stumped me. I do not know They Rule the Night, so it's something I'll have to keep my eye out for. But Bogey, certainly, even prior to his appearance in film noirs like Maltese Falcon, as he was coming up as one of the Warner Brothers contract players, he typically played characters who had a kind of, dark side to them. They were mobsters or people who were in prison, things like that. So I think in just putting him on the kind of other side of the law, he still retained some of that sense of the cynicism and the toughness that was there when he was playing heavies in the late 30s.
That reminds me, I always think of Maltese Falcon as one of the truest book-to-movie adaptations, except I think in the book, Sam Spade is a really tall, blonde guy. but they got Humphrey Bogart instead.
Well, it was, in fact, the third version of Maltese Falcon that Warner Brothers had produced in about a 10-year period. And, everybody associates Bogart with Sam Spade, but, Ricardo Cortez and other people had played him even prior to that.
Go back to our callers now. Thank you for bringing those up, Jackie. We've got Frank now in Onalaska. Hi there, Frank.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First comment on Bogart. I think the one they drive at night, he plays a truck driver that runs afoul of some criminals. And what's funny with Bogey is he's short, maybe balding in the way. He's a tough guy, but he never really has to resort to violence most of the time. He uses his brains. But as a leading man who always gets the girl, it's always struck me that, you know, this short guy that's really not that tough is the hero. But my comment to direct the film away from, you know, the Quintus Bogey as the primal example of the male actor is Cape Fear, which actually was done twice. Once in black and white, where I think Robert Mitchum played the bad guy, wrongly sent to jail by the attorney. In the remake, it's Robert De Niro plays the bad guy, and Nick Nolte's the attorney, who, of course, De Niro and Mitchum come back for revenge in a thunderstorm or a hurricane.
Frank, thanks a lot. A lot of moral ambiguity in both versions of Cape Fear, Jeff.
Yes, absolutely. And both versions, I think, are quite good. It's hard to pick one of them as my favorite. But, of course, mentioned Robert Mitchum. And Mitchum himself, if Bogart is one icon of film noir, Mitchum is very much another one. Because after Out of the Past, he made similar sorts of stories for RKO in the early 50s. And, of course, continued making those kinds of crime films in the 60s and even into the 70s with things like Friends of Eddie Coyle and remakes of older noir titles like Farewell My Lovely and Big Sleep were both remade with Mitchum in the title role.
And to fast forward a bit here, A Walk Among the Tombstones just came out this fall, and we've got a clip here with Liam Neeson.
Your mom home right now? Maybe we can go down and talk, have a cup of coffee.
I can't let you leave here. They'll kill me if I do.
Who's they, Jonas?
The other two.
So what? You're going to stab me now with that big knife?
It's going to bother me, too, for a long time. I know it will.
How much is it going to bother you? I take that knife away and stick it in your neck.
Could you really do that?
Yeah, I really could. But I'd rather not.
That's a fun clip, and I don't know, also makes me wonder if there's always coffee and smoke in noir movies, at least coffee for sure. I don't know. What do you think about that? Does that qualify as noir?
I certainly would include it in the kind of contemporary conception of noir, which people now refer to as neo-noir, in part because it is a more self-conscious updating of the tradition. And it's one of the things that I think you continue to see is there are a lot of current adaptations of works by contemporary hard-boiled writers. And Lawrence Block, who had written the book, has written the series of novels that feature Matthew Scudder as one such novelist. But you also have people like Donald Westlake and Dennis Lehane, James Ellroy. All of these are people who have had films made from the work that they're producing as contemporary crime novelists.
And, you know, other modern examples, our producer Chris Molina mentions L.A. Confidential, a big, Body Heat, sorry, in the 1980s.
Yes, yeah.
Noir never went away completely, did it?
No, it never really completely goes away. And some of this has to do with, in part, the kind of rediscovery of noir by American critics in the early 70s. I mean, one of the most influential pieces ever written about film noir as style or genre was by the filmmaker Paul Schrader back when he was doing work as a critic. And that was published in 1972. There were also pieces that were appearing in magazines like Film Comment by Raymond Dergnat. And, you know, it's kind of that really produced some of the kind of self-consciousness we see about contemporary films and their relation to that tradition. And when a film like Chinatown is released in 74, yeah, it's very much updating the older Marlowe-esque Private Eye film, but quite knowingly, with a sense of what that tradition means to contemporary audiences.
I've got an email here from Andy who says, film noir are some of my favorite movies. The Touch of Evil re-edit is maybe the best film of all time, but don't forget about the great French noir like Le Samurai or some of the British funny noirs like Alec Guinness and The Lady Killers.
Well, it's one of the things that's that it's important to keep in mind, even though the French really thought of film noir as being an American phenomenon. They themselves, even in 1946, saw it as having a strong relation to their own cinematic traditions, and particularly poetic realist films. So not surprising that in the 50s and 60s, you have directors like Jacques Becker and Jean-Pierre Melville, who directs Le Samurai, making crime films that very much fit the kind of noir mold. And of course, you also see British noirs. There's, you know, a strain of British neo-noir that you see with directors like Matthew Vaughn and Guy Ritchie, for example. But you can even go back and look at someone like Carol Reed in the 40s, where The Third Man, Odd Man Out, these are still seen very much as kind of canonical British noir, being produced roughly at the same time that American film noir is.
Now, a lot of the noir staples become almost like a cliche. I can think of parody type things like, well, public radio listeners will know maybe Guy Noir, on, with Garrison Keillor, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, the movie. I know there's there was a running Calvin and Hobbes noir bit called Skip Tracer. It's played for laughs a lot.
Yeah, it is played for laughs a lot. And it's partly because it's very easy to kind of communicate the conventional iconography. You know, all it takes is tough talk and a fedora, you know. And you can see even though the films themselves are somewhat serious, there's almost kind of a tongue-in-cheek quality to the relationship to film noir that directors like the Coen brothers have, where Miller's Crossing indulges in this very kind of stylized language, which they claimed it was kind of their Hammett film. So they're very much mimicking some of the slang that appears, but inventing their own terms, of course. And of course, even something like Brick, which is a teen film, but has this strong noirish element. And even that's done a little bit tongue in cheek, where our, you know, Philip Marlowe in this case is a high school teenager. But the script is written in the kind of vernacular one would expect of a noir film.
To go out with one more clip, I understand you in your class let your students kind of weigh in on what actually makes a noir, and one that's up for debate is Blade Runner.
I don't know why he saved my life. Maybe in those last moments he loved life more than he ever had before. Not just his life. Anybody's life. My life. All he'd wanted were the same answers the rest of us want. Where do I come from? Where am I going? How long have I got? All I could do was sit there and watch him die.
A bored-sounding Harrison Ford doing the voiceover in the original theatrical release of Blade Runner.
Smoky-sounding, not bored.
The sci-fi noir?
Yeah, I think it is. The long-term reception of Blade Runner is such that even books on it talk about it as future noir. So it was conceived that way very much. Part of the gimmick of the film was, you know, it's being produced around 1980 with this idea that it's set 40 years into the future, but using some of the costumes, hairstyles, iconography of 40 years in the past. So as much as people dislike Harrison Ford's voiceover, and I can understand why, he particularly apparently hated the idea. But it was the kind of thing that, if nothing else, it really strengthened the relationship to that noir tradition, where the world-weary voiceover of the detective is often a kind of trope that you see in many of the older films.
Well, Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That was Jeff Smith, professor of communications at UW-Madison. His classes include one on film noir, and he was with us to help celebrate Noirvember.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for our state news roundup. Today we take a look at the state's projected budget deficit and what's behind all the talk about a presidential bid from Governor Scott Walker. Noah Ovshinsky joins us now. He's WPR's assistant news director. Welcome back, Noah.
It's good to be here, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. Well, for a long time now, There's been a lot of talk about whether Scott Walker, Governor Scott Walker, would run for president. Most of that talk's been from people who aren't named Scott Walker. Are things starting to change now?
I think perhaps, I will say. In interviews with national media this week, Governor Walker has suggesting, but not coming out and saying it, mm-hmm. but suggesting that he and his advisors are, in fact, preparing a run for president.
Now, I know there's a lot of attention to this piece with Politico. What kind of things is he telling them?
Yeah, right. So in an interview with Politico, among many things, I'm just going to quote directly from the article because I think it sort of illustrates what we're talking about. He said, quote, I think there's going to be a hunger for a leader who can actually get things done. The closer I've gotten to this position, the more I've realized that anyone who really wants to be president has to be a little crazy. The only way you should run is if you feel called to.
But did he say, hey, Politico, yeah, I'm in?
No. He told Politico that he hasn't decided whether to run yet, but it is clear that he and his advisors are, you know, talking pretty seriously about it. He told Politico that a potential campaign headquarters would be located in Madison. He also asked close aides just after this recent election to stay on to help him prepare for a possible run for the White House.
So what kind of things would this staff be doing? What kind of things would he be doing between now and that election to bolster his credentials?
Right. So this article we're talking about basically says, you know, Walker is designing a budget and a legislative agenda that he is going to use as the basis of his presidential run. Of course, we talked about a few of those things that came out in press conferences here in Wisconsin, you know, after the election.
So what are some of those things that would be on that agenda?
Yeah, repealing the Common Core standards, requiring drug testing for those on public assistance, cutting property taxes, even more. You know, take those, assuming they are passed by the legislature.
And he's got a Republican legislature likely right. to be sympathetic with those goals. A lot of them have expressed wanting to do exactly those things.
Exactly. Take those and combine them with, you know, Walker's battle with the unions. And, you know, you have a pretty potent conservative message.
And there's a lot of people thinking of running. Is this part of the goal here to, I guess, contrast him with likely competitors if he should run, if they should run?
Yeah. I mean, I think Walker and his advisors, you know, hope that his record, both what he's done in the last 3 years as well as what he's going to do early next year, you know, that record will stand in stark contrast to what's happening in Washington, D.C., you know, as well as the states where his potential competitors in a presidential primary would hail from, including Louisiana, New Jersey, Ohio, Texas.
So did he send any other signals this week?
Yeah. So Walker told U.S. News and World Report that his family is on board when it comes to a possible presidential run. And again, I'm going to quote directly from the article. You know, he said, quote, I think right now my wife would be on board for just about anything. He says, I couldn't do it without the support of my wife.
Now, these are questions that came up during the race for governor. What was his response then?
Right. So he never... Basically, what he said, both in debates and in press conferences around the state in the run-up to that election, he said that his plan was to serve a full 4-year term. It was his plan to serve that term. He never promised to, but he said that was his plan. So, you know, throughout the campaign, a pretty non-committal response.
So we'll probably be watching to see if he gets his political passport stamped in places like, Iowa, New Hampshire, other early primary states, swing states, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, back home in Wisconsin, we have a budget to pass next year, and we got some budget news today that may, I guess, shape what legislators and the governor have to work with.
Right. So we just talked about some of the things that may be on that agenda. Of course, the budget is a big part of it. And the big takeaway from the numbers that were released this week by the Walker administration, the budget is not looking great. It shows that there is a $2.2 billion difference in what state agencies want to spend in the next 2-year budget and the money that state government will actually have on hand.
All right, so let's tackle part one there, the spending side. What kind of increases are state agencies looking for?
Yeah, so as a whole, they want around a 5% increase in general fund spending in the next fiscal year. And a 6% increase the year after that.
These are budget requests. Are they carved in stone or is this kind of a wish list? Are they going to get what they're asking for?
No, you use the exact term that I would use. It's a wish list. Exactly. You know, that said, you know, some of these agencies, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room, you know, unless big changes are made to their budgets. And when we talk about this projected deficit, you know, big changes may have to be made. When I talk about not having a lot of wiggle room, you know, I would say the Department of Health Services would be an example. You know, it runs Badger Care. And, you know, the question is, if we're looking at a deficit, you know, are we looking at cuts to Badger Care? And that, at that point, at this point, at least, it's an open question. But there, in some of these agencies, there's not a lot of wiggle room.
Now, this is, we've been talking about the next couple of years here. There's also some revisions, I think, to what they anticipate in our current budget cycle.
Right. So the same numbers that were released this week also discussed the current fiscal year. And it's, again, projecting that we're looking at ending this this fiscal year with $130 million deficit. And, you know, that can go up, that could go down, it could stay the same. It frankly all depends on whether the revenue projections, you know, actually come true.
So these revenues were projected some time ago, I gather, in the earlier budget process. Have revenues, for the most part, been meeting expectations in that budget planning process?
Right. So the estimate we're talking about assumed a revenue increase. And when we say revenue, we're talking about essentially tax mm-hmm. revenue, an increase of 5%. The reality is, at least through the first quarter of this fiscal year, revenues are coming in around 2.5% less than that projection. So that $130 million deficit we're talking about, you know, could realistically grow as we move through the next few months.
Now, these are requests for that for the next couple of years from different state agencies. Anything surprising in this report on what we're seeing from them?
Right. I mean, obviously, we're talking about wish lists here. It's, you know, no guarantee that this is what the agencies are going to get. The Department of Transportation, interestingly enough, is asking for really a substantial increase in the amount of money it gets from the general fund.
So, I mean, we've heard a lot about transportation budgets this last year. We had, it was a little overshadowed by the governor's race, that referendum, the constitutional amendment, sequestering, in effect, transportation money. This is a complicated part of our budget.
It is tricky, and it's becoming more so because people are driving less, cars are becoming more fuel efficient, which means less gas taxes that are being collected in order to support road construction.
Let's stick with transportation for a couple. Where is the department hoping, the Department of Transportation, hoping to find money to make up those things you just said and pay for road projects here?
So Secretary Mark Gottlieb released a plan late last week that basically outlines what he would like to happen, mm-hmm. where he'd like to get that money. He'd like to create a new fee on new vehicle purchases, create a fee for hybrid and electric vehicles. He'd also like to restructure the current gas tax in a way that yields even more revenue.
So, okay, I go to buy a new car. How does this fee on vehicle purchase work for
right.
me?
Right. So it wouldn't be a flat fee. According to Gottlieb, it would essentially be calculated as a percentage of the sale price. So the more you pay for the car, essentially, the more you would pay in this fee.
So these are the kind of things where, okay, you're using the road, you're buying a car, whatever. That's where road money is coming from. Anything outside of that, though?
Well, the secretary also wants about $575 million transferred from the general fund to his budget. And just as a reminder, the general fund is what pays for K-12 education, the state's share of Badger Care, Department of Corrections, UW. I mean, this is essentially where your income and sales taxes go.
So this is a proposal. It's not a law, not in stone, not a budget yet. What's next?
Right. This is a proposal. He submitted his plan to the governor's office, and it's basically up to the governor to decide, you know, what he's going to include in his budget when it comes to transportation funding. Again, in many ways, this is a wish list like we've been talking about, and it'll largely depend on what the governor wants to take from that and include in his next budget.
Well, these things are going to fuel our conversations over the next year. Noah, thanks as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That was Noah Ovchinsky. He's WPR's assistant news director. Joins us each week at this time to round up the top stories in Wisconsin news.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.